RadioInfluence.com.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the fantastic Wednesday edition of the Dark Delight Podcast with
Hump Day Val
and me, oh, you see, you and your pause.
I delayed. It's just too early.
It's me, Beans. We're recording the show early today because I begged Frank to get up early so that I would be able to live tweet the entire Horowitz hearing today for you. So, you know, we record this in the morning. You guys hear it in the afternoon. But it is right now 8:02 a.m. Eastern time.
Yes. And it's not too early. But I usually don't present myself in front of a microphone this early. Because
you don't even have morning voice this time.
Yeah, well, I don't know. You want to know the weird thing is that I was waking up every 30 to 40 minutes for the last 3 or 4 hours.
Ew.
So, I don't know.
I woke up at 4:30 this morning, like it was like time to go out and do stuff. And I was like, uh-uh.
Yeah, no, I woke up the first time at 5:55 and I was like, oh wow. I still got like an hour and a half, 2 hours. This is going to be great. And then I woke up again at 6:30. I said, I still got another hour because I set my alarm for 7:30.
So. Well, you don't have morning voice, which is great because usually you're like,
it's all good.
Here we are.
So then, what's on the agenda?
Oh Lord, what a day today. So as everybody knows, on Monday the IG report came out on FISA abuse, and we're gonna dissect some of this today. Go over some of the things that I found that I'm not seeing very many people talk about. Had a great time talking to you last night on the Quite Frankly podcast.
I got so many good reviews about it, Tracy, because it was, above all things, very short and sweet and got around to all the important points without drowning people in minutiae.
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot of broadness we can do with this. It doesn't all have to be, you know, at 7:52 on, you know, the 17th of September, this person did this. In comparison to other IG reports that I've read, it was very easily read if you understand, it's hard to say, like you could read it and understand immediately what the hell happened and that it wasn't good, right? Even if you'd never, ever, ever paid attention to the story before. Mm. However, if you have been paying attention to the story, it was still relatively easy of a read. It wasn't like the Confidential Human Sources report. You know, so it was a very good report to read. And I want to say off the bat, the reason why Frank and I talked about this a bunch of times on the show, the reason why I've always said do not read the conclusions is because the conclusions I've been trying to explain, the conclusions are just like, okay. Horowitz is not a U.S. attorney or an investigator that goes in to find some kind of a crime or something like that. He's an administrative guy. So while he does make criminal referrals, if he identifies a blatant abuse of the law, his job is not to go in and find mistakes to make criminal referrals. And that's why the criminal referrals he has made are such a huge deal. And I've been trying to stress that. He goes in there to try to find administrative malfeasance. So if somebody tells him something and he doesn't find any evidence to the contrary to disprove them and say they're lying, he just says, I was unable to find anything that told me that this wasn't true, right?
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, if there are no procedures, rules on the books for certain things, he doesn't say this was a crime, this was against the rules, this was blah, 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 they shouldn't have done this. He says, take this place where there's no guidelines for you and please implement some. I hope that helps to kind of clear up his perspective and why his conclusions aren't as important as what is inside of his report. He says several times in there, we're not here to speculate on what someone's motive was or why they did what they did. Mm-hmm. We're here to tell you what they did. And if there is no evidence to prove what they did was nefarious or, you know, if, for example, he says, we were unable to find any documentary or testimonial evidence that bias played a factor in the beginning of the Crossfire Hurricane investigation. What does that mean? Well, a lot of people come back and say, Strzok and Page were texting, they hated the president. Obviously, there's bias. Horowitz acknowledges that, but he says this entire thing was started by Bill Priestep, I'm sorry. And Bill Priestep doesn't have any texts or emails expressing bias that Horowitz could find. So because he's the decision maker and Peter Strzok is not, that's why he came to that conclusion. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and it wouldn't be surprising to me if these are all considerations that were made by the plotters along the way, just like obvious considerations were made by James Comey with the leaking of the memo, or what could protect him, what can protect him in a court of law with, you know, leaking some but not all information. And, you know, you remember what we were going over when they had decided not to press charges against James Comey for the leaking?
Yep.
You know, it's just so it's little things like this where I say, well, hey, if these are career employees at the company, they have to have picked up all of these tricks along the way and known how best to how best to protect themselves as they coast into uncharted waters.
Yeah, agreed. And in addition to that, you know, there are a lot of tricks employed here, a lot of them that Horowitz calls out. So all of this being said, there was a lot of people who were really, really down about this report because they didn't know what was in it yet. All they did was look at the conclusions and say, oh, this is a whitewash. It's not a whitewash. It is damning for the FBI. And for the parts that everybody thought were a whitewash, Barr and Durham mm-hmm. both came out and told everybody, relax, don't worry about it. We've got this. And we're going to go over clips from Barr's interview on NBC and at the end, and I'm going to detail them and we'll talk about them and analyze them if there's time. And I want everybody to breathe a sigh of relief because not only was the IG report 100,000% necessary to set the table, this is the tablecloth underneath what will be a gourmet meal of deep state accountability.
At least for this top layer of this nonsense, this dental dam that they are. If you really, I keep coming back around to it. This is really just a top layer of icing to protect the cake underneath for this deep state. That's just really it. I mean, all these crimes, this conspiracy was only in response to the election. We're not even talking about generations of manipulating the entire world and the country itself. So it's guys, do one thing at a time. Obviously, got to go in order. But this has been like extracting teeth.
Yeah, yeah. It's been a process, right? We've been waiting a long time to get here, and here we are. One of the tricks employed, Frank, just kind of going off the cuff here, was that, and James Comey knows this. That sanctimonious little, to take a book page from your book, he lost his security clearance, which everybody should be happy about, right? Everybody should be happy about that. When he was interviewed by the IG, which he did voluntarily, okay, there were a lot of people that interviewed voluntarily. Christopher Steele interviewed voluntarily. Loretta Lynch, I believe, was interviewed. Rod Rosenstein, I believe, was interviewed after the fact as well. Who else? There's a bunch of people that were interviewed voluntarily. Horowitz said, would you come in for an interview? They said yes. James Comey was one of them, right? James Comey didn't have a clearance and pretended to not remember anything. We talked about this last night. Didn't remember signing both renewals of the FISA warrant. Didn't remember anything. Horowitz was like, you know what? Let's get you a quick clearance so that you could take a look at this classified and secret information we've got. And he said, no, I don't want it. He used that to skirt being able to look at the documentation he could have looked at to be able to flag him. The fact that he doesn't have a clearance anymore should tell people something. Everybody's been, you know, on Twitter for a while now. Why do these people still have their clearances? A lot of them don't. You just don't know it. So
when did Comey losing his clearance become public knowledge?
In this FISA report.
Okay. So we've only known this as of Monday.
Yes, we've only known this as of Monday.
Okay. Because I this is the first time I'm hearing it this week too.
It's hold on. Okay. Just want to pull something up. So what we're going to do now is just go through some of the things that are not being talked about from what I can see. I did a thread where I pretty middle of the road without too much of my opinion broke down what is in this report from start to finish in segments. It's a 45-minute read on ThreadReader. So if you want at 48, it's 160 tweets, 48-minute read. If you guys want to get a good idea of what is in this report from start to finish, the very key highlights, please take a look in the show notes and you'll have a link to the ThreadReader app webpage. So you don't have to go on Twitter if you're not a Twitter user. Also, real quick before we start, and I'm going to be talking a lot, Frank, just interrupt me, tell me to shut up, whatever.
Okay.
If you guys have reached out to me via email, one attorney reached out to me via the contact form on my website and sent me something absolutely brilliant that I need to look into, and I haven't responded to you yet. Just bear with me and I will get back to everybody over the weekend. Everybody that I can, there's a lot. So I'm going to do my best to get back to everyone. Okay. So Horowitz mentions in here that he was allowed to see some reporting from other departments and was given unfettered access to top secret information, et cetera, so on and so forth. So he was allowed to see information from like the NSD or the CIA, blah, blah, blah. Only information that the FBI was maintaining from those organizations. So he couldn't go and ask for something from them or have unfettered access to their stuff. But if they were sharing intel with the FBI, he could see that, just to get that out there. There's a couple things that haven't been talked about. Number one, what I found interesting, we talked about yesterday on the show, and you had some good points here, so I want you to say them again.
Okay.
Steele relied on a primary subsource who relied on a bunch of subsources. He had no firsthand information for the dossier, which formed the basis of the Carter Page FISA warrant as a whole. It did. There's no denying it now at this point. In one section of his dossier, he talks about how WikiLeaks got the information they used to drop the DNC leaks and the Podesta emails from Russia. The FBI got their hands on this subsource and was interviewing the subsource to validate the dossier during this process after they had gotten the first FISA warrant, right? When they were interviewing the subsource denied saying anything ever about WikiLeaks and Russia. So where did Christopher Steele get the idea that WikiLeaks hacked received the stuff from the DNC and Podesta from Russia?
Probably from somebody who thought it would be a really, really good way to tie a nice tight knot on the Seth Rich theories.
Right. Precisely. Now, why is this important? Obviously, for those of you who've been listening to the show and following the story, who know what's actually really going on, it's important because this means that not only from two perspectives. Number one, it means that Christopher Steele fabricated things to put in his dossier with no sources to back it up. On the other hand, it means somebody else was telling Christopher Steele who wrote this, who, you know, this information, and he wrote it in his dossier. The problem is Christopher Steele was asked about that and said, yes, they did. They did too tell me that. So Christopher Steele still pinned it on the original subsource who denies it rather than saying, oh, I must have gotten it from someone else. So he doubles down on the source of the information rather than expose who actually gave it to him or who told him to put it in there. Now, interestingly, this ties into another point that no one's talking about. In the IG report, there's a person identified as Source 2. Source two is Stefan.
It was me. No, it was me.
It was you, mother.
It was me the whole time.
Jesus.
All right, so Stefan Halpern, go ahead.
I knew there was something off about you this entire time.
I'm very off person.
So source two is Stefan Halpern, and Stefan Halpern comes up to them and says, "Yeah, you know what? They approached him to be a confidential human source and record people inside the campaign, and who weren't with the campaign anymore." In quotes, right? But he says, "Oh, coincidentally, I was asked to be on the campaign."
And Stefan Halpern?
Yeah, yeah. And I haven't given him an answer yet. So they leveraged Stefan Halpern, who said he had no interest in joining the campaign, but had worked on several other presidential campaigns in the past, as per him. They leveraged his offer to work on the campaign that came from somewhere we'll get into in a second. They leveraged that in order to have him, you know, have access to people that he wouldn't normally have had access to, with a relationship and a reason to talk to them. And they made it very clear in the report that they told him several times, "We're not asking you to join the campaign," because if they were to have asked him to join the campaign, then they're using a confidential human source to embed itself into a presidential campaign, which is a huge no-no that even they acknowledge would have been absolutely horrible. But they did it anyway without admitting it. And we'll get to that in a second.
See, this is what I'm talking about. For as big of an operation this was, they knew. I mean, they all know what can and what can and will come back and bite them. So for as shoddy as a job this actually was, because the longer it went on, the more exposed they were, they're still, it's impossible to be a successful liar.
So Halpern goes to Papadopoulos. He's recording the conversation, and I had a little error in my thread in the beginning where it said that it was consensually recorded. And of course, I'm not a lawyer or anything like that, so I thought that meant that Papadopoulos said, "Yeah, you can record me. I'm an idiot." No, it's like almost like the two-party consent laws or the one-party consent laws where the source can consent to being recorded, which makes it legal for him to record anybody.
Okay.
There are some states where you can't do that. You need both parties to consent to recording. But Halpern consented to being recorded, which allowed them to pick up whoever he was talking to. So he's talking to Papadopoulos, and he asks Papadopoulos about the Russians getting dirt on Hillary Clinton, the supposed predicate for the entire investigation, which Barr and Durham dispute being valid at all, and possibly even having things happen before this, which I'll talk about. And he asks him about the Russia stuff, and Papadopoulos gives back the response he's told everybody he's given back, that it would be treason against the law. He has no information to suggest that that's happening at all. And the people, the agents that are monitoring the call and transcribing these things say it was a very canned, lawyerly response. It didn't sound organic. It sounded like he was, you know, coached to say it, right? And what I found interesting is that they sent another person in and also had them wired up to talk to Papadopoulos. We don't know who. And they start talking, the two of them, about this and about the Russia emails, the Russia email to WikiLeaks stuff, and the Russia has 30,000 emails on Clinton, etc. And Papadopoulos says something really interesting to that other source who he doesn't realize is a source. He says, "If I would have told him anything else," this is paraphrasing, "he would have probably taken it back to the CIA. And I don't know who the heck got the emails. It could have been Russia. It could have been China. It could have been a disaffected, angry Bernie supporter." Now, there's two things in there to unpack, right? What's your perspective on what was said? What are the two things do you think to unpack?
I mean, I like the suggestion so far.
So it's Seth Rich, right? Disaffected Bernie supporter leaking the DNC emails, something that we've speculated for a long time. I have to go back in here and check the date that this was said to get an idea of if it was after or before all of the quote conspiracy theories about Seth Rich and how far in it was, you know? Mm-hmm. But the thing that really flagged me about this outside of that was the fact that somehow George Papadopoulos knew Stefan Halper was a CIA asset.
That comes out in this clearly?
He says he would probably have taken it back to the CIA. So the FBI thinks he's giving a canned response. And then when asked later by another source that Papadopoulos isn't keen on, he gives the same answer generally. But he says, I had to say it that way, or he might have taken something back to the CIA. Hmm. How does Papadopoulos know that Halper is a CIA agent?
I don't know. Aside from he himself, we can go back to the old Papadopoulos, a plant or a patsy guy. Mm-hmm. I'm telling you, I was on both sides of that fence. And then after a few months into learning about this situation, especially the situation that was focused around Papadopoulos, I ended up thinking he was a plant turned patsy.
I'm not quite sure yet which it is. I will tell you, though, I've spent time in person now in social settings with George Papadopoulos. I hosted a panel with him on it. I did that interview. He knows a lot more and has a lot more to him than he's telling anyone. And I would say that to him. You are hiding something. I know it. The world knows it. You know, let it out, right? There's just more there that he's not letting on. But he seems to be earnestly involved or earnestly looking to unpack this story. What his role was, how he knew CIA Halper was CIA Halper, how he knew this stuff is beyond me. But, you know, hey, Halper collected exculpatory information only from both of the people he was sent in to be wired up on, including Carter Page, who was very transparent with Halper from the very beginning that all of the reporting about him and Russia and his connections and what he was doing was incorrect and fake news, that he'd never met Sechin before, that, you know, he couldn't believe that this was all happening. He had to figure out a way to combat against it. He's being tarred and feathered in the media. All of that was told to Halper. Halper did, you know, obviously the FBI transcribed it. The FBI, rather than putting that in to the warrant application or letting the division that, you know, is supposed to send the application in, know this information, they completely hit it, blatantly hit it. So there are 17 things they did wrong in here that are just basic that I think everybody knows at this point, but we'll go over them quickly. Number one, they hid exculpatory information from the FISA court. Their entire case blew up after January, and they knew it, and they still lied, fabricated evidence, hid exculpatory information, beefed up the validity of Christopher Steele, saying that Christopher Steele was, you know, his information had been used in criminal probes. It never had. So they did all kinds of things wrong. Peter Strzok and Bill Priestep went over to London to interview people about Christopher Steele, asked them all kinds of questions. They got a mixed bag of results. Some people saying he was 100% spot on all the time. Other people saying, you know, he boasts, he brags, he makes things up. He's too focused on his conclusion. Things that were detrimental to give question to whether or not Christopher Steele was a good source.
Well, we spent three weeks on the notes written by Kathleen Kavalik.
Right, right.
I mean, it should have been dead right there.
Speaking of which, another State Department employee who declined to be interviewed, who had massive contact with Steele, your friend and mine, Jonathan Weiner.
Oh, my God. A man I don't like, but his last name does make me get in the mood of cracking open a bottle of wine, though. Or it makes you think of a guy that just whines constantly.
Yeah, it's a bad name.
Okay.
Certainly.
So now that I think about it, it's more like the second than the first.
Yeah, much more so. So Jonathan Weiner declines to be interviewed. So does Glenn Simpson. So does Glenn Simpson. Surprise, surprise. So anyway, so they have all this negative and positive information. They bring it back to his handling agent, who was, I believe, Joe Pienka, of course, involved in the Flynn case and with Strzok and et cetera and so on and so forth. Somewhere along the line, those teams get swapped out and new people come in. And there's some speculation as to why that happened. I'll be following up on in the future. But Pienka apparently says, you know what, let's do a validation report on this source. And he goes to the validation unit that looks at sources and gives back a report. Should be using these? Should I not be using these? And they get their, they give them all the information. And the validation officer doesn't include the negative stuff in his file. And when asked why he doesn't include it, he says, well, we give people the benefit of the doubt. Well, what the F is the point of doing this if you're not going to put the stuff that raises doubt on your source into his file? You just ignore the bad stuff and keep the good stuff?
Mm-hmm.
Ridiculous. So that was a factor in here. They, you know, to get this FISA warrant, they had so many violations of the Woods procedures where people would make things up, would not include documentation to support their facts that they're asserting. There's a chart at the end of the IG report that goes over all the times that agents messed up the Woods procedure. And the Woods procedure is there so that they know, and the court is confident, because there's no hearing here. They didn't ask for hearings, and there's no defense on behalf of Carter Page. The court assumes that these Woods procedures that validate all of the information inside of the report is factual, are there to do that. So the court has confidence that they have valid facts in the warrant application, and none of those procedures were followed at all. Some willfully not followed. So the IG report excoriates the FBI on their handling of the Woods procedure, which is the basis for the FISA warrant. On the FISA stuff, the IG completely takes the FBI to task on their handling and says there was willful ignorance. So they totally didn't follow the procedure on purpose. They bolstered evidence that they knew wasn't true. They wanted this warrant to spy on the Trump campaign. And one of the things in here that's said is that Rod Rosenstein is interviewed, and I'm sorry, black hat, no other explanation for this. He's asked, you know, why did you go ahead and approve this at the DOJ without, you know, this such a sensitive thing in a sensitive time? And Rod Rosenstein's answer is, well, I really wasn't worried about the political ramifications of it because Carter Page wasn't on the campaign anymore. You know, Rod Rosenstein, Stein, whoever, you know that this warrant is retroactive and two hops. You know that. So he knew that just because Carter Page wasn't on the campaign anymore didn't matter. And he said it anyway.
Right.
He's hiding something.
And the other thing that I have not heard anybody bring up again in a while regarding Carter Page is that he was more of a known quantity, especially to the Federal Bureau of Investigation, for years.
Yeah.
He was pretty much working with the FBI as recently as March of 2016, the election year.
CIA. Yes.
I thought it was the FBI that he's working with against Russian organized crime in New York.
CIA. He was a CIA asset even into the 90s. He's been a CIA agent forever.
Okay. Well, either way, he was still on the books in the first quarter of election year.
Yeah.
So for everybody to know that this guy was not owned by the Russians, they knew.
There was overlap, too, into the FBI's investigation into him. While the FBI was trying to get these warrants, he was working with the CIA as a cooperative informant. So here's the deal. This is what happened with Klein Smith, Frank. Klein Smith reached out to the CIA to ask them about Page being a source for them. They responded in kind, saying, yes, he is a source. He's been, I forget the word that they use for it. And it's not source, though. Whatever the CIA calls them, it's not source. So they give this information to Klein Smith. Klein Smith edits the email from the CIA to say that he wasn't a source and then tells everybody working with Carter Page that he wasn't a source. Jail. Klein Smith is going to jail. That was maliciously edited email just so that they can continue their surveillance.
Goodbye, Klein Smith.
Klein Smith is headed to prison.
Along with Rod Rosenstein.
I don't know if Rod Rosenstein is. I think that he flipped.
Nah, I feel like the greatest thing that we can all do is put in the memory banks. What have we seen? What have we seen here? Because That the what we're seeing right now should not be forgotten.
No,
that's all. And, no. And the people involved, they should not be forgotten, and they should never be trusted as if they ever should have been trusted in the first place. So we're getting as a if we're ever going to be a free people again and really live inside of a free country again, we at least need to start working with some good information. And I don't know. Yeah, I can as much as I'm excited about what we're seeing here. I can also I wouldn't you know disbelieve you if you came from the future and said, "Oh yes, we sent Clyde Smith to jail." Everybody else is still around though.
I doubt that that's true. And
I understand. I understand.
No. The only reason why I doubt that it's true, I know that you wouldn't be surprised, and I understand what you're saying, but I doubt that it's true because in Barr's interview, he makes a very careful distinction about who was involved in bad stuff and who is doing a good job. He makes a careful distinction, and I don't think many people picked up on it, but we're going to go over that clip in a few minutes.
All right.
So that's why I think Brennan, Clapper, Comey, McCabe, Strzok are going to be accountable. The big guys, the big dogs, right? So I will be happy if Brennan, Clapper, Strzok, Comey, McCabe are all in handcuffs. I'll be happy. Anyway, one other thing in here. You know what? Hold on one second. There we go. One of the things that I wanted to talk about. I'm laughing because we paused the show for a second and then we just did a whole little segment on Bruce Orr and wasn't recording.
I know. And it was funny, too.
It was funny. One of the things that nobody's talking about and I don't understand why is Bruce Orr. Bruce Orr has a whole section and he was the conduit between after Christopher Steele was dismissed as a source from the FBI, Bruce Orr was the conduit between Christopher Steele and the FBI. And again, Bruce Orr is a DOJ guy. He inserted himself into the chain of custody in terms of evidence, which is a huge no-no. Because now a DOJ employee is in the chain of custody when it comes to these facts from, or not facts, lies from Christopher Steele into the FBI. Bad, 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 bad practice. He doesn't tell any of his immediate supervisors that he's doing this because he doesn't want his immediate supervisors to tell him to stop. He doesn't want to stop. So.
Can't stop.
Can't stop, won't stop.
He went to go see a therapist too.
Again.
And he's just like, I just can't stop. I can't stop. I want to. Just can't do it.
Round two is better. So he hides this from his supervisors who are all aghast. They're aghast that they could possibly be doing this. But one of the things that's not being focused on is that Bruce Orr is working closely with Weissman on a Manafort investigation that is apparently stonewalled in the division within the Justice Department it's being run out of, which I can never remember the name of, and I'm going to find right now.
National Security Division?
No, it was a like financial fraud.
FinCEN?
No. Come on. I can't find the name of the department, and it keeps on escaping me for some reason. There was an investigation into Manafort ongoing when he joined the Trump campaign that was stalled out wherever it was being held. And a small group of these folks, Weissman or Strzok, Page, and this guy Swartz would get together and talk about how they could speed this investigation along to get Manafort, right? And they didn't tell anybody on the investigative team in that other department what they were doing. They just did it behind their backs, trying to figure out a way to get this information in. Now, Orr was working as the conduit for Steele. Steele's firm, Orbis, was representing Oleg Deripaska. Why is this important? Manafort allegedly owed Deripaska money. There was a falling out between the two of them years ago, and Deripaska was owed a lot of money, allegedly, from Manafort. So Deripaska was working through Steele into Bruce Orr, into the FBI, who had no, and DOJ, who didn't have a very high opinion of Deripaska, even though Deripaska helped to engineer the escape of Levinson from Iran and was called down. He had a plane on the tarmac waiting to take him out of there, and Hillary Clinton called it off at the last minute. There's a long storied history with Deripaska and the FBI. We'll put it that way. So Deripaska is persona non grata. He's sanctioned the heck out of. He can't come into the country. His visas are all denied. He's working through Steele into Bruce Ohr to try and get those things reinstated by feeding information in to speed this investigation along against Manafort. And Weissman is involved in this, right? And it's during this time that Weissman gets the information from the journalists about Manafort's storage locker. Remember that?
I do. But vaguely, is there a way to nutshell that real quick?
Very easy. Weissman meets with reporters who give him information that Manafort has a storage locker where he's keeping things. So basically,
is this where the little black book thing came from?
No.
Okay.
Black book was Ukraine and the DNC and Chalupa.
Okay, got you.
This was inside the Mueller investigation. Weissman goes after the storage locker that he learned about from the press. Let's not even get started about how effed that is. Oh, Lord in heaven. I can't. So Weissman, surprise, surprise, takes custody of this investigation they were working behind the scenes to speed along when the special counsel starts. So Weissman is involved with Steele, also taking information from Steele. It's just Bruce Ohr is funneling. Now, the other thing about this Deripaska connection that nobody's talking about, and I included this in my thread, is think back to when we got those Signal text messages released between Adam Waldman. Adam Waldman is an attorney for Christopher Steele and Orbis, Oleg Deripaska, and Julian Assange. Very interesting trifecta that he's representing. And in he's texting back and forth in Signal with Mark Warner, the chairman at the time of the Senate Judiciary Committee.
Wow.
Saying Christopher Steele wants to talk to you.
Really? Me?
Yeah.
Okay.
So Steele is performing work for Waldman, who is representing Deripaska. Waldman is also representing Steele.
So this is, was this all around the same time? Because of course, Waldman, Warner, they're also trying to bring Julian Assange in at one point too. And the kibosh was put on all that. Was this approximately around the same time?
Yes, sir. All at the same time.
What twisted webs we weave, Trace Lynn.
Yes. It's crazy. It really is. So another black hat that I just have always thought is a black hat that I've had pushback on, Jeff Carlson disagrees. So Jeff Carlson and Brian both think that Rosenstein is a good guy.
Rosenstein.
I disagree with that. I don't think so. I also disagree about Dana Bonte. I've said from the beginning, I have reason to think that Dana Bonte is a bad egg, and he is. Dana Bonte is involved in all of this. He becomes the acting attorney general. He gets the application. He reviews the footnotes about Steele being closed as a source. They still include the information. They don't update. It's very bad. Very bad. The whole thing. I just disagree with him. I could keep talking about this report, Frank, for another 20 minutes, but I really want to get into the clips from Barr.
Let's do it.
Because they're important to this. They put a bow on it all, okay? Here's the deal. Regardless of any conclusions that piss off the... quickly, one more little tidbit I found. You know how we were talking about the Flynn case and the handwriting, and Sidney Powell brought in a handwriting expert and all that nonsense?
Another one vaguely, yeah.
So they're trying to distinguish whether the handwriting was Strzok's or Pienka's, and they couldn't tell because there was no other samples of Strzok's handwriting that they could use to contrast. There's a question about who wrote the 302 notes. Was it Strzok? Was it Pienka? And there was no way to verify whose notes were whose. They weren't labeled. And there was no other handwriting samples that could be found from Peter Strzok. Well, in this IG report, there's a little section in a footnote that says that Strzok was unable to read back what was in his own notes. So he couldn't read his own handwriting. That is very telling because the 302 notes that were written, one of them is very neat, detailed penmanship, and one of them is chicken scratch. And if you're trying to figure out who wrote what and Peter Strzok's admitting he can't read his own handwriting, likely chicken scratch. So I sent that along to the proper parties.
Wow.
Anyway.
Writes like a doctor, huh?
Pretty much. So here's the deal. The bar interview was damning for the deep state players and vindicating for all of us for a number of reasons. We're going to listen to clips of it now. I've got several. We're going to listen to them all because I want to document them here on the show and we could talk about them after.
Okay.
Here we go. We'll start at the beginning. Brennan's going to be invoked here.
And the governor of New Jersey, former U.S.
He's basically saying, I don't understand why nobody went and talked to the Trump campaign about this. There were trustworthy people on the campaign. There was a former U.S. attorney in Chris Christie. There was an Intel committee member. Nobody was talked to about the fact that there is a possibility Russians are trying to infiltrate the campaign.
Yeah, and why? And I understand that from the get go, they're trying to create suspicion around Michael Flynn as well. But outside of that, how much more trustworthy can you get with a person like General Flynn? You know, you're talking about people involved with the campaign that you can talk to about some kind of a security breach or some kind of a dangerous situation. So, in a world where they weren't already trying to frame him. There's also him that you can go to.
Yeah, and so, their excuse the whole time for not doing this is that they didn't want to alert anybody that there was an investigation because that would hinder their ability to find who was actually doing the wrongdoing. Bullcrap. Here's Barr.
Attorney, there were people to talk to. And what I find particularly inexplicable is that they talked to the Russians, but not to the presidential campaign. On August 4th, Brennan braced the head of Russian intelligence. He calls the head of Russian intelligence and says, we know what you're up to. You better stop it. He did it again later in August. And then President Obama talked to President Putin in September and said, we know what you're up to. You better cut it out. So they go and confront the Russians, who clearly are the bad guys, and they won't go and talk to the campaigns and say, you know, what is this about?
So the inspector general says he found no evidence to indicate that the FBI's decision to start this investigation was.
Hold on. Governor of, here we go.
Political bias. Do you agree?
Well, I think you have to understand what the IG's methodology is, and I think it's the appropriate methodology for an inspector general. He starts with limited information. He can only talk to people who are essentially there as employees, and he's limited to the information generally in the FBI. But his approach is to say, if I get an explanation from the people I'm investigating that is not unreasonable on its face, then I will accept it as long as there's not contradictory testimonial or documentary evidence. In other words, it's a very deferential standard. And all he said is people gave me an explanation and I didn't find anything to contradict it, so I don't have a basis for saying that there was improper motive. But he hasn't decided the issue of improper motive.
Have you?
No. I think we have to wait until the investigation, the full investigation is done. And that's the fundamental distinction between what Durham is doing and what the IG is doing. Durham is not limited to the FBI. He can talk to other agencies. He can compel people to testify. One of the problems in the IG's investigation, I think he would agree, is that Comey refused to sign back up for his security clearance and therefore couldn't be questioned about classified matters. So someone someone like Durham can compel testimony. He can talk to a whole range of people, private parties, foreign governments, and so forth. And I think that is the point at which a decision has to be made about motivations. And I think right now it would be premature to make any judgment one way or the other.
Yeah, bullshit. He did make a judgment. They made a judgment when they made the statement that they disagree with his conclusions.
Yeah.
So he's being diplomatic, right? This is, go ahead. No, he's shaking his head.
I was just going to say, yeah.
Oh.
I was just going to keep saying yes.
Okay. Well, that's great.
Very easy. I'm an easy color guy.
Here we go.
Well, I think the big picture. I just wonder, though, about what the FBI would say, I think, here is, okay, so they opened an investigation. Nobody was ever charged. They were concerned about possible Russian meddling in the election. Why not open this investigation? What's the harm? You've said intrusive means. So what is your concern about the fact that they did this?
Well, I think the big picture is this. From day one, remember, they say, okay, we're not going to go to talk to the campaign. We're going to put people in there, wire them up, and have these conversations with people involved in the campaign, because that way we'll get the truth.
In quotes.
From the very first day of this investigation, which was July 31st, 2016, all the way to its end in September 2017, there was not one incriminatory bit of evidence to come in. It was all exculpatory.
Now, I don't know if anybody caught that. I'm just stopping it. To its end in September of 2017. That was in the middle of the special counsel. September of the special counsel is still going on, guys.
And that the only information that was coming in during that time was exculpatory.
Right. So what he basically, there's more to this clip, but what he basically just told you was that Mueller knew and ended his investigation into Russian collusion in September of 2017.
And just let the media stretch it out for another year and a half.
Yes.
Because it was such a faulty premise for an investigation. He couldn't even justify. There wasn't even anything to actually physically stretch it out to encompass the 2018 election, which this was at least designed to bring them to the midterms.
It was May of 2017 that the special counsel was appointed, correct?
Yeah. So he was done in 6 months?
That's what Barr just said.
Jeez.
I don't think many people caught that. But anyway, here we go.
People that they were taping denied any involvement with Russia, denied the very specific facts that the FBI was relying on. So what happens? The FBI ignores it, presses ahead, withholds that information from the court, withholds critical exculpatory information from the court while it gets an electronic surveillance warrant. It also withholds from the court clear-cut evidence that the dossier that they ultimately relied on to get the FISA warrant was a complete sham.
There's more.
They hid information about the lack of reliability even when they went the first time for the warrant. But in January, after the election, the entire case collapsed when the principal source says, I never told Steele this stuff. And this was all speculation. No, and I have zero information to support this stuff. At that point, when their entire case collapsed, what did they do? They kept on investigating the president and well into his administration after the case collapsed. But here, to me, is the damning thing. They not only didn't tell the court that what they had been relying on was completely rubbish, they actually started putting in things to bolster the Steele report by saying, well, we talked to the sources and they appeared to be truthful. But they don't inform the court that what they're truthful about is that the dossier is false. So that's hard to explain. And the core statement, in my opinion, by the IG is that these irregularities, these misstatements, these omissions were not satisfactorily explained. And I think that leaves open the possibility to infer bad faith.
I think it's premature now to reach a judgment on that. But I think that further work has to be done, and that's what Durham is doing.
The other thing here, too, is if we know that there was an attempt to get this FISA warrant in June or July 2016, it didn't work. And finally, they hit the mother load. They were actually able to provide enough information that convinced the court to give them a warrant in October 2016. And then they had subsequent renewals prior to New Year's Day. And then for James Comey in January 2017 to still say that the dossier was unverified and salacious. Is that in any way, shape, or form taken in, under consideration? Was that statement made under oath, or can that be played off as James Comey being playing his cards close to his chest and just engaging in a little public misdirection? Was that statement under oath? Because if it was, it begs the question: how the hell he can even admit that what was such a large part of those FISA application processes would still be salacious and unverified after three renewals already?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think he did give testimony under oath to committee about that. But the thing here is, another thing that you just flagged me on that hasn't really been talked about at all is that the CIA and the FBI were warring back and forth with one another. Andrew McCabe was adamant that the dossier be placed into the intelligence briefing, the intelligence community assessment, as a fact that was, you know, leaning, that gave proof that the Russians were interfering in the election. And Brennan said, no, we're not including this at all. We think it's rubbish and internet rumor. And so they're fighting back and forth with one another, almost like the FBI wants to say, you're putting this shit in here. This is all your fault. And the CIA is saying, there is no way in hell that we're putting this in our ICA. Uh-uh. Absolutely not. So there's talk that the dossier was laundered into the FBI via the CIA. And I think that this is the FBI's way of saying, I want this in here so that it's in here, you know, cover your ass. Mm-hmm. And it ends up going in there as an appendix. It's not the dossier, you know, as a whole. It's just what they have written about the dossier and the intelligence in it. But it goes into the ICA. They make a happy compromise, I guess you could say. And another thing, James Comey tells President Trump about the salacious and unverified information, right? And then the media leaks it. And then Peter Strzok uses the media reports as a cover to go talk to Michael Cohen and Paul Manafort about what was leaked in the media, rather than saying, we're in the midst of an investigation here called Crossfire Hurricane. Will you help us? So more misdirection. But your point is valid and taken, Frank. I just can't answer the question.
Yeah, it's more of a question than a point. It's just one of those things that I've always wondered, because that was a public statement. And now that the timelines have been, you know, largely filled in, it makes you wonder, was that just a public, you know, head fake, or was it a serious statement being made under oath, which would be incriminating in itself?
Well, no, not necessarily, because the statement's true.
Well, but it's true. But to then go back and say it tells you it's true that it's salacious and unverified. But then to go back and reassess the process of applying for spy warrants, it makes you wonder, OK, well, how did you actually get this? Why were you allowed to use this to get approval from a court? So then it brings up questions about the legitimacy of the court. Did you lie to the court? How did you cover up and not really address the fact that this was salacious and unverified at first? Because if you brought that up,
from the beginning, they said that the dossier had nothing to do with the Carter Page FISA warrant. Adam Schiff's memo said it. All of the stupid media said it. Everybody on the side of evil said that it had nothing to do with it. Nunes's memo disputed that completely and said absolutely it had to do with it. It was based on it entirely. So the entire time, you know, there was an argument back and forth by people saying like, you know, we couldn't confirm a lot of the intelligence. It was completely bull. Or, you know, there were salacious and unverified parts of the dossier. And now, only now, do we know that they knew internally, do we have proof that they knew internally that it was nonsense and just ignored it? So I guess they were just biding their time until this report was finally released. And they're just, you know, now they're just asking for everybody to apologize to them for some reason. Anyway, here's some more.
Well, Durham is looking at the whole waterfront. He is looking at the issue of how it got started. He's looking at whether or not the narrative of Trump being involved in the Russian interference actually preceded July and was in fact the precipitating trigger for the investigation. He's also looking at the conduct of the investigation. There are some things that were done in the investigation that are not included in Horowitz's report, and he's looking at those things. But also, a few weeks ago, I told him that he should spend just as much attention on the post-election period. And I did that because of some of the stuff that Horowitz has uncovered, which to me is inexplicable.
Inexplicable.
Well, what I said is their case collapsed after the election, and they never told the court, and they kept on getting renewals on these applications. There was documents falsified in order to get these renewals. There was all kinds of withholding of information from the court. And the question really is, what was the agenda after the election that kept them pressing ahead after their case collapsed? This is the president of the United States.
And there were several other sources inside the Trump campaign that the FBI claims they didn't use, which is complete nonsense. Well, I want to try and think. This is the last one we'll share, and then we got to call quits for the day, amazingly enough. We can pick up more on Friday. Here we go.
The grand jury and his investigation isn't done yet. Whether something is appropriate or not. Was it appropriate for John Durham to issue his statement yesterday, given that he's a U.S. attorney with the grand jury and his investigation isn't done yet?
I think it was definitely appropriate because I think it was necessary to avoid public confusion. I think it was sort of being reported by the press that the issue of predication was sort of done and over, even though it was a very limited look at that issue by the IG, given the narrowness of his, of the evidence available to him. And I think it was important for people to understand that Durham's work was not being preempted. And that Durham was doing something different, and he explains what he's doing different, and that there are areas of disagreement. I think it was perfectly appropriate so the public understood the relationship between the two exercises.
So you the...
Dun-dun-dun.
Yeah.
It was for you. It was for you so that you could calm down, take a breath, and understand there's much more here, and they are working on it. They finally came out and calmed the collective movement, right? There's no basis for anyone anymore at this point, at least for the foreseeable future, to doom cry, fear porn anybody into nothing's ever going to happen. Nobody's doing anything. It's all a big farce. You just can't say it anymore.
No.
So
it doesn't seem. No, that certainly doesn't seem that way.
So they're going to have to find a new job. Instead of scaring everybody all the time.
New jobs.
Yeah, they're going to have to actually do something, you know, worthwhile instead of scaring everyone all the time for no reason.
Stop scaring people.
Boo! I saw you jump, Frank.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's it for today. I'm going to live tweet these hearings all day. Thank you for doing this early with me.
You got it. When does it start? In an hour?
10 o'clock, yep.
So what are you doing for the next 55 minutes?
Well, I have to write up this show. I have to process everything, send it over. I have a business call I have to make that's been on the books for a while. And then I got to sit down, eat a little breakfast because I don't get up from my chair for hours.
Cottage cheese?
No. Probably a whole grain English muffin with a little butter and jelly.
Cottage cheese and blueberries.
That's good. Or
cottage cheese and blueberries is great. It's better than cottage cheese and pineapple.
You know, my grandpa always used to eat cottage cheese. That was his favorite thing.
Yeah, my grandmother, she introduced that to me too.
It's an Italian thing.
She would actually line a bowl, a cereal bowl, with leaves of lettuce, and then she'd put the cottage cheese inside of the little lettuce cup she made.
That's cute.
Yeah.
With grapes anytime?
No.
My grandpa used to have it with tuna.
Pineapple.
My grandpa used to have it with tuna fish.
What, a lettuce cup?
Cottage cheese with this tuna fish.
Cottage cheese and tuna fish?
Yeah.
I've never had that before. That sounds like it clashes.
It would, but it's good when you have some nice tuna fish next to the cottage cheese, not mixed together.
Okay.
On the same plate. Right.
Okay, maybe that works then.
Yeah. And my uncle is like a tuna fish connoisseur. He used to make all different kinds of tuna fishes. And he used to put wheat germ in it, which was interesting.
Wheat.
Because it would suck up the extra liquid and make it nice and, you know, good. And he would put all kinds of different things in there. I used to love my uncle's tuna fish. Anyway, you guys have been listening to the Dark Delight podcast with
Snowy Hump Day Val and
me, Beans. You guys can hear us every Monday, Wednesday, Friday on TuneIn, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, Apple iTunes, iHeartRadio, and RadioInfluence.com. We will see you back with more, much, much more on Friday.
See ya.
This is a Place for My Head quick fix on Radio Influence.
And another thing that's not in this article and drives me nuts, and we're all guilty of it. I'm guilty of it. But, man, it doesn't matter where we go. If you walk in to McDonald's, if you walk into Macy's, if you walk into a high-end restaurant, it doesn't matter. Just take a look around for just a couple minutes and just observe your surroundings and how many people have their phone and they're just staring at the phone across the table from their person that they're having dinner with or their family, and they are also looking at their phone. And it drives me nuts because it takes the people and personable and like the relationship skills and all that kind of stuff. It hinders all of that, and people aren't interacting with people anymore. I'll text you. I don't want to talk to you though. I'll message you on social media, or I'll, you know, whatever. But all that's easy for them to do. But get a person in front of a person and actually interact that way without having to do it through social is damn near impossible nowadays.
Yeah, you know, I've seen a bunch of studies lately where they're talking about, well, the birth rate over the last 5 years has gone down. Well, no shit.
Yeah, they're on their phone instead of having sex.
Yeah. Well, let's take the sex aspect out of it. There's no interaction.
Yeah.
People don't know how to communicate anymore.
Mm-mm. Sad.
And it's scary because, you know, one of the essentials of human life
is interaction.
Is interaction.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
chemistry.
Yeah.
All that stuff.
And it's just not happening like it used to.
Mm-mm.
And again, I know we sound like, you know, the grumpy old men and whatever, but, you know, we're trying to look at this realistically. Not everything you see on social media is real.
A Place for My Head with Brandon Thompson and Jerry P. Tuck can be found on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Podcasts, and RadioInfluence.com.